Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, the show that takes you inside the Texas and federal appellate systems. Through conversations with judges, court staff, top trial and appellate lawyers, academics, and innovators, we provide practical insights to help you become a more effective advocate. Whether you're handling appeals or preparing for trial, you'll discover strategies to sharpen your arguments, innovate your practice, and stay ahead of the latest developments. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Elizabeth Alvarez, who's at Guest & Gray. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here, guys.
So, Elizabeth, tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of what you do and how you got into that.
I am the head of civil litigation and election litigation at Guest & Gray. I went to law school in California at Pepperdine, and then I worked for a nonprofit for a little while in Dallas, but most of my career has been civil litigation of some kind, but I've been doing election litigation for 12 years.
Todd and I have both voted in elections, and that is about the extent that we have knowledge of election law. So we're glad to have you on here to talk about that. How did you get into election law? I mean, that's an interesting niche.
I used to be a long time ago. In a previous life, I was the vice chair of the Dallas County Republican Party. But that was like a long time ago, and it was a lot different then, and it was larger. I didn't really understand why we could never find a lawyer. I was like, why can't we find a lawyer? There aren't any. There's like two. And then I figured out we should probably get one of those. And then I thought I could do that. It was an unpleasant learning curve. But since that time, I've become one of the main litigators of election litigation in the state. And there really aren't that many. As the practice develops, I've represented, you know, state parties, national parties, candidates, judges on both sides of the aisle. I think it's very interesting type of law, but it's very demanding and it can be stressful because of the accelerated nature of the calendar. I've also served as the House Election Committee attorney for a few sessions as well. So I've had a lot of involvement in drafting some of the amended parts of the election code in an attempt to make it more practicable for attorneys to use. It was not really terribly thought out the first time around, I think. We have a unique system in Texas. A lot of states have an automatic enforcement mechanism for election code that includes, you know, campaign violations to voter suppression, turning voters away. I mean, any kind of election related incident, like our neighbor, for example, Georgia has a whole administrative division and they have a court that is assigned attorneys the same way that a federal administrative agency, they have their own courts. They assign lawyers and other states do that. Several of our neighboring states do that. So that it goes straight there. Other states have the attorney general as a main responsible person with original jurisdiction over election litigation. And while that used to be the case in Texas, the problem is that most or the majority of the immediate relief that you would need from a court in an election matter has to go through a private attorney. We just don't have a system or regulatory scheme in Texas to assist you with virtually anything. If you are turned away at a polling place or you're registered to vote and they won't let you vote or they wrongfully reject your provisional ballot, maybe your opponent didn't really get all the petition signatures they need to get on the ballot. You can file a complaint with your local DA's office or you can file a complaint with the Secretary of State, but they're not going to fix it and they're not going to do whatever you need to get immediate relief. The legislature has seen fit to put that in the hands of private practitioners. So most people don't realize that they're directed on most occasions, oh, this happened to you, fill out this form, file it with the Secretary of State. Well, you're not going to hear back from the Secretary of State until 6 months after the election. They'll send you a letter that says, we've read your complaint. We've decided that, yes, this person did violate the law or this practice violated the law. So we are now going to launch an investigation into this issue. But the election's over, right? So you didn't get to vote or your opponent got to stand for the office, even though they shouldn't have been, or whatever the issue is, those ballots were counted and they shouldn't have been, or someone's ballot was wrongfully rejected by the ballot board, that's over. And there's no fixing it. There's not really any mechanism for state intervention to correct those issues because we largely run elections on a volunteer basis, which is also a unique practice. Most states don't do it that way. Our primaries are run by your local county chair. Most of them contract, every single one except for one county, which recently decided they didn't want to, but they contract with the county elections department to run the election, but they are the authority administering the election. So your local precinct chairs are electing a chair. Well, you elect a chair on the general election ballot or the primary ballot, rather. But if that vacancy, if they resign or can no longer fill that spot, the precinct chairs can elect a replacement. But either way, the number of people who are choosing the party chair is pretty small. It's whoever's voting in your county on that primary ballot. That individual is now in charge. The Secretary of State, all the money that they use to process elections and administer them are going to go in a Secretary of State account. It's an elections administration account that the county chair is now the boss of. So we have people who have no administrative experience whatsoever of any kind. Maybe they're the boss, maybe they're a lawyer, maybe they're not. Maybe they're the county chair of a medium-sized county. You know, and 2 weeks ago, they were managing Staples, but now they're in charge of your right to vote. And they get access to that money. They now have to engage in this long, complicated process to choose your judges, choose your clerks. They choose where you vote. They have to make sure that those locations all get contracted with. They have to make sure they're paying a fair price. Every place you vote is rented. The government's paying for that through the party chair, who is going through and contracting with all of these different locations to run the election for your primary. They're also paying the judges and the clerks. Now, the money may get processed through the county, but they're the ones paying, and that money comes from SOS, and they have to account for every single dollar. So we're running elections on this sort of lower decentralized level because Texas has always kind of been that way because it started out so large. We always just kept thinking we can do it. That's the reason we have such high jurisdiction in JP courts. We're addicted to that romantic idea that regular people can handle it. It'll be fine. So you end up where the legislature said, well, we don't really want to establish a whole agency to police this stuff. So why don't we just make law that you can get an attorney and they can fix it for you. So Chapter 273 of the Election Code has a writ of mandamus that's statutory and an injunction that's statutory. And I'd say roughly 90% of election litigation comes from those two provisions. There's a attendant one in 161 of the code, and that's for like party chairs or other party officers. And then you have the section for election contests, but that's not a very common usage of the code. 90% of the code's use in a court setting is the writ of mandamus and the injunction. And they have a little bit different standards than your common law one. But that's how most people, if any relief is possible for them, that's where they're going to get it.
So why is it that contests are not as common as mandamus or injunction under the code?
So contests are really complicated, and the trial schedule for those is really advanced. An election contest, maybe everybody doesn't know, but it's the way you challenge an election result. The courts and the code divvy up the kind of relief you can get based on what you're trying to challenge and what period in the election schedule we're in. If you're challenging a candidate's eligibility, you know, they don't reside here, something of that nature, you have to file it before the ballots go out for the primary. You may litigate it afterwards, but it has to be filed before those mail-in ballots go out. If you're challenging whether or not your opponent got enough signatures, if you're challenging a ballot board action, election judge action, a county action, all those actions are going to be writs or injunctions. An election contest is solely to challenge the results of an election by arguing that ballots were counted that should not have been, or ballots were not counted that should have been, or a person in charge of the election prevented somebody from voting, broke the law, or made a mistake, such that the true result of the election cannot be ascertained. That's the only thing you can argue when you're talking about election contests. It's a really, really steep hurdle, and the amount of time you get to litigate them is incredibly small if it's for a primary. So any contest going on right now, for instance, I think it's 232.008 talks about contests for a primary or where there's going to be a runoff. Those are even more expedited than regular contests. And 232.0012 talks about the deadlines for that. So when you file a petition for an election contest, it has to be filed within 15 days of the canvass. If you have a recount after the election is canvassed, a canvass is when they finalize the election, right? So when you vote on election day or early voting or by mail, you're just trusting your ballots are getting counted. There's a whole bunch of things that are happening in the background. You've got a ballot board and a signature verification committee that are working for weeks, process mail-in ballots and get all those situated and organized. And then the tabulation for early voting cast in person, none of those votes can be tabulated until the polls close for early voting. So once that's all done, now you have election day. After election day, you still have to wait 7 days because people who vote provisionally, they have 7 days to come in and prove that their ballot should be counted. So after that day, you have a total of 11 days from the day of the election to get it canvassed. That's when the authority, whoever's in charge, says, these are the official results. We accept these results and we're signing off on it. Once that's done, that's considered to be the public posting of the results or the publicly available results. From that day, if you want to challenge the results, and you can file for a recount or you can file a contest. A recount is not like the recounts in Bush v. Gore. We don't get to examine hanging chads in Texas. A recount is just the votes that have been counted. A lot of times people will file a recount because they're convinced that there's secret mail-in ballots that they didn't get to get counted, or that maybe the machine is tricking them so they want to do it again. It's almost impossible for the machines to be hacked. It's really, really, really difficult to have a machine issue. The only kind of mistakes that machines make really are undervotes and overvotes. And an overvote is when you vote for more than one person in the same race. And an undervote's when you skip it. Every once in a while, you'll have a voter who maybe they're so enthusiastic that they love James Tallarico that they circle his name instead of filling in the bubble. The computer, the Scantron, it's a glorified Scantron machine, right? So when it reads it, your circle crossed into the field for Tallarico and for Jasmine Crockett. So it thinks you voted twice, so it doesn't count it. And sometimes people are really in a hurry and we tell people when you vote, fill in your bubble, make sure your bubble's dark. And if you're just bubbling it a little bit, maybe the machine doesn't pick it up. So it thinks you undervoted. In a recount, we pull out every single ballot that was counted and we hand count them again in teams of four. Every once in a while, you'll find a ballot in the box. It'll say there are five undervotes in the box, but it turns out that most of those ballots, you can clear voter intent to vote for a particular individual. The machine didn't pick it up. So you can change those votes. Or maybe the machine thought you voted twice, so nothing counts, but it's clear the voter's intent was to circle Tallarico's name. So when we retally that, we're going to switch that vote. You know, that when we do the new tally at the end, it's going to have an extra vote for Tallarico because recount judge determine that that's what that ballot really meant. Any ballots that were rejected, mail-in ballots that didn't count, that's not part of the deal. Those never get brought out. Only the ones that count get brought out and you count them again. So you really aren't going to see much of a change. People do that if they're super close, like really close. The statute allows you to do it if you're within a certain percentage or if you want to challenge the machine results, but really it's not advisable to spend the money because they're really expensive. Because you're paying for the staff. When you do a deposit ahead of time and they tell you how much it's going to cost, and it can cost. When I do recount, I've had to do several recounts, for example, for Representative Morgan Meyer, when the race is really close to the general and his opponent filed a recount. Those things cost 50, 60 grand. You have to pay it for all the staff. They're counting them in tables, and depending on how many tables, you're paying for four staff members per table to hand count ballots for days. And before they do that, because we have countywide voting, they have to go through all the boxes and pull out every ballot that was voted in that House race and then put the others back and then triple count to make sure we physically have every physical ballot that matches the number of total votes count. And that takes days ahead of time. So
I was curious, Liz, about, you know, you talked about bubbling in the Scantrons. Are there any Scantron-type ballots still being used in in-person voting anymore, or is it all machine voting? And so I guess the corollary to that is the hanging chad issue or the virtual hanging chad issue, is that only for mail-ins, really, these days as a practical matter?
Yeah, in terms of the type of ballots used, when election bills change, like when SB1 changed the type of machines you can use, they usually give counties a significant amount of time to buy that equipment and change it because each of those machines is super pricey. So some of the smaller counties may have gotten extensions, right? And they're stretching out the time they're allotted to switch machines. But almost every machine in the state has reached the point where you're inputting your votes on one machine and it prints out your Scantron and then you're running the Scantron through the other machine. But we're still in a time period where within the past decade, multiple large counties were still using the hand-filled-in Scantrons, especially on Election Day. But now that we're moving to a countywide voting system for Election Day, it's just too much trouble to facilitate having that many different ballot styles physically available when you can order the Scantrons with the serial numbers that can be printed by the computer based on whatever we're coding your precinct to be when you vote. It's just an easier way for people to handle it. So it's not really a very common situation. Most of the time, when you're looking to challenging votes in a contest, you're looking at people who were assisted who shouldn't have been. Sometimes you have issues where people will trick the elderly. I'm not saying it's very common, but it does happen. I've litigated several cases. We're not talking. There's no thousands of people, you know, stuffing ballot boxes. That's not a thing. There are people in the state, there are cases of individuals who, what they like to do is they will, most of the time they target the elderly. They like to steal the mail-in ballots from the mailboxes. They fill them all out together, or they can convince the person to sign something and they think it's a petition or whatever to fill a pothole, but it's an application for a ballot by mail. And you'll figure it out when they're all mailed. You know, maybe there's a neighborhood over here and all these mail-in ballots have a stamp on them from a post office, you know, an hour and a half away, and none of those people can drive. And we, you know, we'll subpoena them, we'll talk to them, and the last person they voted for was Kennedy, you know, and they don't know. They're not even sure they're registered. And I mean, that's a real thing that does occur, but I think in a post-Trump era, people are inclined to be concerned that that's never happened. To be clear, the things he said happened have in fact never happened, did not happen. He made it up. And people are getting disbarred for that, and rightfully so. But there are legitimate cases of ballot issues. But most of the ones I've seen are people who shouldn't have been allowed to vote, but they did, or people who shouldn't have been assisted with their ballot, but they were. There's instances like that. A lot of cases in South Texas have those kinds of vibes where they have what's called politiqueras, and they sort of collect people and then drive them all to the polls at the same time and have somebody go in with these individuals. And then when they leave, they'll pay them money. But like I said, it's not a common practice. So I don't want people to get the idea that that's a thing that's happening every time you vote, because that's not true.
Surety bonds for court-related matters are a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. CSBA has over 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA is able to provide first-class service with their deep understanding of the appellate process and the various timeframes involved in getting a bond in place.
I think you mentioned this in connection with primaries, but maybe it applies more broadly. We were talking offline before we started recording about the limited experience that Jody and I have in this area of the law, which is one of the reasons why we're super happy to have you with us today. I recall from, I think, the one instance that I had an election. It was, I believe it was a contest. One thing people forget about besides the just, or they don't know about at all, besides just the accelerated timelines, is that one reason why they're so accelerated and the deadlines are such is that once those ballots go out, once the ballots are printed, there's very little that could be done. Like if the mail-in ballots, I remember, I think is kind of what drove that. Is that accurate or what's the connection?
We have something called the Ferguson Rule. And so the Constitution gives the legislature the authority and right to set the time, place, and manner of elections, which means they set the calendar, they set the schedule. As part of the schedule, mail-in ballots and ballots to people overseas have to go out 45 days before voting begins. The Supreme Court has held that although courts have broad equitable authority in Texas to issue any kind of relief they see fit to ensure access to the ballot, access to voting, etc., that authority ends if it would interfere with the election schedule. That's different for something like a Voting Rights Act case. When you're talking about that, you're talking about constitutional rights, but there's no such thing as a right to be a candidate on a ballot. Supreme Court's been very clear that that's not a right. And as long as we're not talking about rights, you can't change the schedule. The judiciary doesn't have that authority because they view it as a violation of separation of powers. Once they've changed the schedule of the election, then you're supering the legislature's authority to set that time, place, and manner. Therefore, they call it the Ferguson Rule because it's the case started, the quotes they like to use is since the days of Ma and Pa Ferguson, blah, blah, blah. But basically what happens is if you can't finish in time for all your appellate deadlines to have been run before that ballot goes out on the 45th day, it doesn't matter if you filed on time, you're done. So in practical terms, we have to start accelerating election procedures because that time space is really limited. If you think about a municipal election, there are people who will turn in their applications to run for school board or city council, right? And the election's in 4 weeks. So if the election's in 4 weeks, maybe they don't have early voting sometimes, you know? But either way, there's a date by certain by which the ballots have to go out. You have to be done before that date, completely finished. So the election code has provisions written in that allow you to file your writ directly with the Supreme Court. They have original jurisdiction over Chapter 273 election writs. You may also choose to go to your local district appellate court, but you don't have to. It's your decision. It's one your attorney has to make based on the different demands of your situation. And your injunctions have to be filed in a district court in the county where the candidate resides. If it is an office that is wholly contained within one county, then you have to file in that district court, right? But if you're a congressional office, there are other places you can file. If you go to more counties, there's jurisdictional specifications in the election code for where you can put these. But your injunction has the same sort of binds. So there are often times when you could choose to file either an election or a writ, and there are several factors that'll help you decide, because appellate courts can't resolve fact issues, and that doesn't change when you're talking about election writs. So if you have a factual dispute, you might need an injunction, which means that you need to think very seriously of how much time you have before you run out, right? Because if I file an injunction, I might skip a TRO entirely and file a notice for an emergency injunction hearing, set my hearing in 3 days, have my hearing, have my witnesses collect facts, I get denied or I get granted, and then it provides for an immediate appeal to either the Supreme Court or your local appellate district court. The loser gets to decide where they're... If you are in the middle of an appeal and you start approaching the deadline, then they'll just dismiss your case as moot, because they have to, you have to be out the door. You have to remember, not every county prints its own ballots. Most counties still order those ballots out from a few vendors, which are approved by the state. So if your ballots have to go out September 3rd, that means you have to have your order into your vendor by a certain day. And maybe they can print corrections, you know, for one ballot for one race, but the larger the race, the harder that gets. If you're talking about county judge, they have to reprint every ballot, right? You have to find out. And a lot of times elections administrators will say they can't possibly, and judges will say, I don't think that's true. I think you don't want to. Obviously, I've never seen a judge say, you are lying to me, right? But I've seen judges say, I find it difficult to believe that that's an impossibility, and drag in a vendor to find out actually how long it would take. But at some point before the day the ballots go out, you have to have a cutoff. So once you get close to that period, they'll start saying, okay, well, the ballots are going to go out. If you're in the middle of an appeal, you didn't ask, and you didn't notice the court that it's an election matter, and you didn't get an expedited briefing schedule, and you're in the middle of a briefing calendar with, say, the 4th district, right? And the ballots have to go out in 3 weeks, you're probably toast if your opponent files a motion, because they're going to say, even if I finish my brief and they do their reply, then you're going to decide. For the loser still has to have time to go through an entire appeal to the Supreme Court and a briefing schedule and a denial or an order or argument or whatever. And we don't have any more time left for them to, they need, you know, and they need at least a week to get ballots reprinted for a race this size, for a city or county this size. And the ballots go out in 3 of those weeks. So we have 2 weeks to be done, and they'll never be finished. At which point, sometimes some courts will say, well, we're going to keep going until we get within a couple of days, and then I'm just going to kick it if we can't be finished. Other courts will say, I think this is a waste of my time, because even if I rule, whatever I say is going to get reversed and remanded, because we're out of time. So nobody wants to spend all their time hearing oral arguments at 8 p.m., you know what I mean? And reading briefs that you gave an attorney 12 hours to write, just to have the Supreme Court say, why did you do that? It's moot. Nobody wants to do that.
That seems to be, of the Supreme Court mandamus opinions in election that I see, those are the ones that you see a lot is, well, you should have told this sooner, because we're not going to help you.
It gets really difficult, though, because, and we obviously are all respectful of the court, and they do a great job, I think. But every once in a while, you run into the problem that they have not been in private practice for an awfully long time. For instance, an election contest, I have one right now. The election code says that when I file my petition, that I have to notice the district clerk, that they have to forward it to the authority, and that the district clerk has an obligation. They shall, it's mandamusable, they shall tell, alert the district judge in the court that it is assigned to, that it is an election contest. Then another provision triggers an automatic recusal. That judge is required to recuse himself. No judge in that district may stand. And then the chief administrative judge must assign me a judge from out of district, and that until I get a judge, the chief administrative judge can sign any order as is necessary. But it also says that from the date of service of the petition, the contestee, which is the defendant, you know, they have 5 days to answer, not 10, not 21. They have 5. That answer is due at 10 a.m. on the 5th day. And after they file their response, the trial must be set for a date not later than 5 days from the date the answer was due, or the day the answer was filed, whichever is later. So as a side note, and I was listening to your previous podcast with Judge Meacham, and I was like, if you want to talk about clerks being mad about the summary judgment, They lose it. When you tell them this, they're like, you got to be kidding me. I am not kidding, ma'am and sirs. Ladies and gentlemen, I just work here the same as you. But they get real mad about that. What happens is there's a series of things that have to happen for this to happen on time, right? So they've got to tell the judge and their coordinator, depending on whether they have a centralized docket or a non-centralized docket, you're getting this new case. It's an election contest. You need to sign. You need to recuse yourself today, this afternoon. We got to forward this stuff to the chief admin judge. We need a new judge immediately. Because from the date of the answer, right, you get 5 days to hold the trial. And 232.012 D and E talk about the one continuance you're allowed is for 10 days. And that's it. Not 10 days or more, not multiple. One 10-day continuance, either for cause with an affidavit in support, or by agreement of the parties. What happens if you file it? There are contests where you'll file it. Maybe it's ahead of a runoff and the district clerk will, I've seen this happen. Someone will file a contest, especially in a smaller school board, that kind of thing. Somebody will file a contest and the district clerk will fail to forward it to whatever authority is administering the election. And since they've not forwarded it, that person just goes, okay, well, we're going to have a runoff, right? And they just start holding the runoff and you can't, if they hold the runoff without you, you know what I mean? That you've been mooted. And so you'll go to the Supreme Court and say they can't have a runoff because the runoff is barred by statute. And they'll say, that's true, but they did it, right? Like if there's no, you can't undo the results twice, right? You challenge this race. We're going to hold a runoff. The winner has been determined. You've challenged this one. You can't challenge it. We're done. Sorry. So now as part of practice, everyone forwards it themselves to the party chair, whoever's administering the election, the school board, the water district, whatever. Then what happens if they do the citation wrong? You know, the election code says that the citation must read that you have 5 days to respond and that it must be returned within 20 days if it can't be served. What happens if the clerk prints it wrong and you call the clerk and you say, hey, I might get bounced because you didn't print the citation correctly. I need you to change the citation to reflect this section of the election code. What should you do if they say, well, I don't want to do that?
Which they always take well, definitely.
Right? Unfortunately, that's the answer. And that's what I mean when I say what's really funny. Although I love the Supreme Court and they're very nice people and they're really good at their job, sometimes I find that they are not as acquainted with how life possibly works for practitioners, because when that happens, their answer is always, well, you should have mandamused that person. Okay, I live here. I work here. The answer is not that there should be a provision where my client gets relief or gets extra days. Right? Because they didn't do what they're supposed to. The answer is if you didn't mandamus the district clerk, right, who will forever reject your filings until you pass away after that date, right? Then it's your fault, right? So that's a problem. Then you've got another problem. What happens if they do the citation correctly or they don't serve it? Or what if you pay them to serve it and they don't? Or what if, I just had this happen in a recent case. We filed a contest and we called the coordinator for the judge where we were assigned because we waited an entire 4 days and still didn't get even an order of recusal. Staff contacted them, opposing counsel tried contacting them, nothing, no response. We called the clerk, the district clerk, and Texas is really large, so I couldn't drive 9 hours that day to go physically to the office and say, hey, I need help. And then eventually we got a reply, and the reply was just a standard printed cattle call hearing set for like 4 months from now. This is not going to work out. You know, we contact them and we say, hey, we need a new judge. And, you know, the trial starts in 3 days. And if we don't have a trial by that day, we only get one continuance for 10 days. We really need somebody to be capable of signing that continuance. The statute does say I can get the chief administrative judge to do that. But as a practical matter, that doesn't show up on his digital things he has authority over because the county or the district never forwarded it. If that judge has never signed a recusal and they're just doing whatever, and I contact the chief administrative judge and say, hey, I filed this contest. I don't have a new judge yet. I need you to sign this order. He'll say, what do you mean? What do you mean you don't have a judge? Or, well, get back to me. You know, you need to go through the proper channels. You need to contact that judge. You need to have him sign the thing. And then once he's recused himself, then I'll sign orders. And then again, you're put in the unfortunate position of saying, hi, I live here. And you are the chief administrative judge of the region that I would like to practice law in. But also you're wrong. And I really, really need to force you. Yeah, they take it super well. Like, I really need to force you to do this thing that you don't want to do. And they're always like, but I don't want to. Then what do you do? The Supreme Court has said again that the remedy for that is that I should mandamus the chief administrative judge. And I think I understand why you might say that. But as a practical matter, that can't really be my only option. So we will do absolutely anything to avoid having to do that. right? That's not a comfortable position to be in. And the other issue is that there's no real discovery, right? Because discovery in Texas is triggered by disclosures, and disclosures are due 30 days after your answer. We'll be done by then. You'll have lost plenary authority by then. So there is no discovery. The only discovery that we have is what's called a motion for inspection and impoundment of election records. So after you get a judge, you set a date for the elections administrator to produce the originals of every single thing you want. It's the only time that those ballots can leave the vault, right? Not in the custody of an LEO. Other than the AG or the DA impounding those ballots, or DPS or somebody, that's the only time anybody who's not them can take them away. So you get this order and you set a date and time for you to go. And sometimes opposing counsel comes, sometimes they don't want to come. Sometimes the judge says, I've never done this before and I want to touch the ballots. And sometimes they go, I don't want to be there. It just depends on your judge. But what happens is they're going to produce all this stuff and you're going to be locked in a room for a whole day, sometimes 2 days, to physically go through every single thing. And then you're going to tell the elections, whichever custodian of records they send, I want these. These are records I need. You pay them to copy them that day. And you can also scan them with your phone. They give you your copies. And then the judge is going to sign an impoundment order for every single thing I want to use in my trial. And they're going to lock them up and with the court, where they lock up exhibits, and then everything else goes back. That's it. That's the whole thing. That's discovery. We try really hard to be nice to our fellow members of the bar, and we all try really hard to exchange witness lists as soon as we have some or do something. But just with the crunch time schedule, there just simply isn't time to even do that kind of paperwork, you know? So you run into a problem when you don't have a judge on time. What happens if you don't have a judge? Your opponent's filed an answer. Your trial's now in 4 days. Because you don't have a judge, and the administrative judge hasn't gotten around to it yet, you haven't even set your day to inspect the files, and you don't have a continuance, you're in trouble. The deadlines are a little bit longer for elections that aren't primaries, but for the most part, that's all you get. You file a contest, you will be out of there in 20 days or less. Some of them are longer. Challenges for general elections can take months, but none of them is ever going to go on longer than 8 months, because you're going to hit it. What if you win? If you win, you have to have a new election, right? And that election has to be noticed, and that one has to have early voting, and that one has to have the 7-period day after it to accept provisionals, and then you got to canvass it. There's a built-in period of time of at least 6 to 8 weeks where if you win, this is what has to happen. You have to build that in. So if you're litigating one now, even if that deadline didn't exist, the Ferguson rule would prohibit you from waiting much longer. The ballots go out September 3rd, and most counties need that information, you know, mid-August, late August. How are you going to finish if you need 6 weeks to have an election and canvass it and wait for provisionals, et cetera? You get 3 weeks max. It's kind of crazy for people, especially if they don't do a lot of trial work, and they go, this can't be that hard. And they sign up for it. And it's like, not only are you getting a trial, but you're getting a trial where you're subpoenaing like 20 witnesses. You have no idea what they're going to say. You've done no depositions, right? You don't know who's coming. You don't know who's not coming. You subpoena a bunch of records. You have no idea what's going to happen. You know, there's no disclosures. There's no admissions. You've got nothing. So you're just like, hi, I'm here for trial. I bought a bunch of stuff. Not sure what's going to happen. I hope everyone's comfortable. It's very stressful, but entertaining, I think. Most of them are really interesting. It is. It's like the Wild Wild West. To be honest, it's crazy. I've had other lawyers. I try to teach as many associates as I can how to do election law, because it's such a niche area. I think if more people can do it, I'm not really into, I want to be the only person who can do this. I don't think that's responsible. What if I get hit by a bus? What are you going to do? I think that more people should learn it. But every time I take someone for the first time, they are severely overwhelmed, you know, because they're like, I don't even know what we're doing here. I don't know what this piece of paper is for. I don't know who this is. I don't know who to call. I don't know what to do. And I'm pretty sure every judge that's ever had me is really tired of me saying, I know you don't want to do this, but you have to. The poor judge I have right now, he wants to go on vacation. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. I can't continue it. You have to try this case in the next 10 days. And that is unfortunate for everyone. And then I feel badly, you know, but it can't be helped. When I was working for the legislature, we explored changing the deadlines, which we looked at various different ways we could do it. And the best we could do was to add 5 days to the non-primary contest, because every time we did the math, we ended up with people are going to file these contests. If we have an extended timeline, they're going to think that that's the only thing which controls when they should do stuff, right? So they're going to do it, file it, try it, spend so much money, and then have a judge be like, that's super interesting. It's moot. Then they're going to be mad. So we just better not.
About how many lawyers, if you have any idea off the top of your head, I mean, this is such a specialized area, as you point out. I really know anybody else who focuses on it the way that you do. And you would think there would be here in Austin because this is kind of a hotbed for that sort of thing. But what is your sense about how many lawyers do practice in this area? Because it's just filled with landmines.
There are a handful, but it also depends on what kind of law you're talking about. If you want to talk about campaign law, you can throw a rock and hit one in Austin, just like you can with a lobbyist. They're, you know, everywhere. Then you've got a whole subsection. I do campaign law, Voter Rights Act, redistricting, and election litigation, like this kind of election litigation, but most don't. There are lawyers who do a lot of civil rights law and also specialize specifically in Voter Rights Act law, like Tex Quesada and Chad Dunn. They're very good at their jobs. You know, Eric Opiella. But in terms of people who litigate, like writs of mandamus and injunctions and election contests, if I had to count, assume it's possible there are ones that I don't know about, there aren't that many election contests every cycle. I get hired to do it all over the state because there aren't that many. And I teach CLEs on the subject. And if you look at the stats from the people in the election committee, they're, to my best guess, because I tried to count this once before, there are like 27 lawyers that I personally think are qualified to litigate a writ. I mean, eventually someone else has to learn. But if you're asking me how many people have done it more than, say, three times, it's like less than 30. And it is crazy.
I should know the answer to this question, but is there a board certification in election law?
There just happened to become one in COVID, during the COVID period of time. Came up with a test. We've just started administering it. People are just taking the test. So there is one. I haven't taken it. I don't think a lot of the lawyers that I work with haven't gotten around to taking it. I know a lot of campaign lawyers are taking it, but they try to make sure the test is equally balanced. But it's hard to do that when you know it's not going to be that common. I'm not sure if that makes sense. It's sort of like those guys, when you find a tort lawyer whose whole career they just sued tobacco until they retired, you know? There are a lot of other people that do tort cases, but maybe not a lot of people that do that. In terms of election law, we want to make sure that people are getting CLE classes in all of the types. But the reality is, unless you are really well known or you're practicing it often and a lot, you can't sustain a practice on just litigating election contests. And there's lawyers in Dallas like David Ray, for example. He's a really good attorney. He's represented parties. He does contests. He does writs. He does other types of lawsuits. There really are not a lot of lawyers who do that regularly, such that it would make sense to focus a whole test on this side, because the opportunity for you to use that is limited, especially if you don't live near a metropolitan area. If you're living in Dallas, Houston, Austin, maybe the Valley, San Antonio, you might get an opportunity because elections happen so often. I have to go to court year round for these kinds of things. Everything from party chairs to they won't release the money to pay my judge or whatever. That kind of work is, there's not so much of it that a person could expect to do that often and a lot, unless they're willing to commit to the idea that you'd have practiced it over several years to get enough numbers. In the 2012, I think, election cycle, for example, I do like 31 writs. It was insane. We tried at some point to find somebody else to take these cases. I feel a sort of sense of obligation sometimes, especially if it's about voter access, you know, they won't count my ballot, they won't let me vote or whatever. I would feel poorly about turning that person away if I know they can't find another lawyer, because if that's our most fundamental right, I would really like to see people recognize the opportunity to offer that as a type of service you can do. A lot of people also think it's very partisan. Oh, I don't want to volunteer to help a party because I'm not that partisan. But they don't realize that you're volunteering to help ensure that they are running an election where everyone gets to vote, where the judges are getting trained, where the locations aren't getting moved or shut down. All those types of things you think about from a civil rights perspective are largely reliant on having an in-house counsel attached to the local party that can help make sure that that happens. If nobody's there to help go to these meetings with the county and the opposite party chair to work with them, if no one's negotiating the contracts and staying up on top of all of those things in compliance with those contracts you might have with the, you know, community college district or the libraries for this elementary school or whatever, you might end up in a position where they cancel the contract and now you have to relocate a voting location for thousands and thousands and thousands of people. Studies have proven that that's detrimental to voter turnout, and that when you move somebody's location, more than 40% of those people will not return, will not vote, even if you give them the name and address of the next location. So there's a reason why you can't just change locations. You know, the law protects citizens against that. You can't arbitrarily change someone's location, but sometimes it can't be helped if it's no longer feasible to place it there. And so I think a lot of people would find fulfillment in making sure that their local elections are run in a way that complies with the law and reduces the amount of friction between citizens exercising their voting right.
Appellate courts have demanding procedural requirements. That's why you need an expert who understands the complexities of every court nationwide. Since 1938, Counsel Press has been the trusted partner of the Am Law 100, providing unmatched expertise in appellate services from e-brief preparation to electronic filing. Their team manages document review and compliance, ensuring your appeals in expert hands from start to finish. Counsel Press, your trusted partner in every appeal. Visit counselpress.com today.
You kind of mentioned it earlier, but the idea of sort of election integrity, and that's become a big hot topic. I mean, what do people misunderstand about that that ends up getting so much argument about it?
I think it's a really touchy subject, and I'm sometimes hesitant to talk about it because I'm always afraid that people are going to have, they're going to walk away with a particular opinion about what kind of a person I may or may not be. I think the idea that all elections are stolen and everything's fraudulent and that there are hordes of non-citizens voting in our elections is hogwash. That's not a real thing that happens. There are people who are voting. It is rare, but there are people who are voting who should not be voting. And every once in a while, there are people who will commit any crime, right? That exists. But most of the time when you run into a person who's voting when they shouldn't be, they didn't know they weren't supposed to vote. The law doesn't make allowances for that. They'll go and they will. If you go to vote and somebody tells you you're not registered, you have a choice. You can either walk away or you can vote a provisional ballot. And if it's a precinct issue, right, like you're registered to vote here, you're registered to vote, but you need to go vote in this other precinct. A lot of people will say, well, I already waited in line here. I'm not leaving. Right. So after the Bush v. Gore situation, that's the thing I get really, everybody has like a little soapbox. I get really mad about Bush versus Gore. Bush did not steal an election. I don't think it was an unfair. What happened in that situation is people voted. We have a largely common rule in the country that you got to vote in your precinct. Right. Until Bush v. Gore, that was largely the rule. What happened is you had people who went to vote in their precincts and were told you are not registered here or you're not registered at all. And until then, we didn't really have a provisional balloting system that would allow you to vote in a sort of limbo situation where we could decide later if it's going to count. That's what provisional ballots are. You show up and say, I'm registered and I want to vote here. You now have a right to vote a ballot. Whether your ballot's going to count or not is a completely separate issue. But before then, we would say, I'm sorry, you're not registered. Sorry, have a nice day. Well, what happens if you find out later that that person really was registered and it was a mistake? Or what happens if they voted in the precinct and if they had voted a mile and a half down the road, that ballot would have counted in the same county, but it didn't count because they voted at the wrong precinct? Is it fair to make people only vote in one precinct? And the Supreme Court essentially said, those are the rules. The legislature set them. We don't have the authority to change them. But we really think you guys should think more seriously about providing an avenue to catch more of these votes so that as many votes as possible can count. That's what happened in Bush v. Gore. If you get rid of the politics and you sort of really read what's happening, is Gore was proposing that people's votes should still count. The Supreme Court was like, we would love for everyone's vote to count if they're registered somewhere and they're a citizen, right? But we can't, it's an acceptable time, place, and manner restriction for a variety of reasons. And that might have come out differently if it was litigated now because of the technology we have, which at that time did not make it practicable to let everybody vote from all over the place because it was impossible to count. If you live in a place with 962 precincts, you cannot keep enough ballots at every single precinct for 962, another 961 precincts. You cannot keep all those ballots, especially when we don't have the kind of technology we have now to scan, print, produce, and count. Right. So after that time, we invented, they had the Let America Vote Act, and we now have provisional ballots. And those provisional ballots allow you to show up and say, I would like to vote. And they say, you're not registered. But if you fill this out, the ballot board's going to look at it. If it's a situation where you forgot to bring your ID and you don't want to go home and ID is required in the state, you have 7 days from election day to bring me your ID. If you show up with your ID, we're going to count your ballot, right? The ballot board's going to look for your registration and the voter registrar. If they find it, your ballot's going to count. If they don't, your ballot will count as a registration. So there are people who are showing up and we're in a sticky situation because our election judges are trained. And it's a civil rights issue to tell a person you're not allowed to vote, right? And it's a civil rights issue to say, I'm not giving you a ballot. But they're also not lawyers, and they're really discouraged from giving legal opinions. And they're not supposed to say, are you a felon? So if you show up and say, I want to vote, they're allowed to say, hey, here's a list of things you have to vote. You please read it, you know? You're not registered, but I have to provide you this option to vote provisionally. So you'll have people who will fill out these provisional ballots, and they are not aware that having a green card means that they can't vote. There are people voting in elections who shouldn't be, but a lot of times it's because they showed up and they were told they could register by a registrar or their neighbor who registered them, who was a deputy registrar, or they filled out a provisional ballot. So that's a thing that happens. They're on the voter roll, but the idea that there is some surplus number of them who are all full of malintent, who are swaying our elections in broad numbers is, I think, unserious. I also do think that the pendulum has swung so far. There are certain groups of people who are invested in the idea that voter fraud will never occur. That is also untrue. I have litigated cases where people literally broke the seals on the boxes, stuffed ballots in the boxes, left the seals on the floor, and walked away. We audit the paperwork, and every single box you have, there's like 400 ways to keep it secure and 400 ways for us to see if somebody tampered with it. When you seal a box, you're sealing it with a seal number, and you write the seal number on a log, and you put it in the box before it's sealed. Right. And the seals are only produced once, and the paperwork, there's all these different ways, but you can't duplicate that. So if you open a box and it hasn't been opened since the central counting room ran it through the machine, and there's more ballots in there than there's supposed to be, and there's more ballots in there than anybody voted at a voting location, and there's a bunch of ballots missing from the ballot assignment sheet, it's very clearly obvious that someone voted them. Who did? I don't know. But we're not talking about 30,000. We're talking about 60 in a small county, 40, 50, 100. In Dallas County, I've seen a couple cases, 4,000 ballots. We're not talking about all of our elections are insecure. If I could tell everybody anything, it's that your vote is pretty secure and that you should have absolutely no concerns whatsoever about using a voting machine. They're safer than paper. They are one of the safest things we have is that machine. It's almost impossible for it to make a mistake other than counting wrong if you don't follow the bubbling rules. I think that's what people get wrong. People don't want to meet in the middle. They don't want to make... I do understand that it's dangerous to meet people in the middle. You don't want to feel like you're enabling them to undermine democracy, because I think that's part of a lawyer's responsibility. I don't want to give anybody the impression that our democracy is unsafe in some way or insecure, because it's not. It is very secure. But that's why it's so important to deal with the few issues of fraud or unlawful assistance or, you know, counting ballots that aren't supposed to be counted or unlawful voting of a mail ballot, because we want to maintain people's faith in the system. But after everything I've seen and touched, I would tell you that those things happen. But the same way that a tort lawyer will tell you that it is technically possible for a truck to flip over and decapitate 20 people, but that doesn't mean they're not going to drive behind a truck. You know what I mean? It is possible. I want people to know that that's a thing and it happens, but I don't want anybody to think that they should be frightened or worried, or that there is no proof that there is a systemic theft of elections, or that there is a systemic breach of the integrity in the counting of ballots. There's no evidence that that is a true statement.
Well, that's comforting to hear. I think one of the biggest takeaways from this conversation to me is just for folks who are tempted, don't dabble. Dare I say dangerous practice area, because there are so many traps that you could fall into. You've mentioned several today that I didn't know about, and I've actually done one of these. A lot of times we think about the deadlines and things from the appellate practitioner's standpoint, and I know the deadlines are super tight for those, but you've covered so many just non-negotiable timelines that come out of all the things that could be litigated involving elections, whether it be contests or getting on the ballot and so forth. So that anybody who's even remotely considering doing this as a practice area or taking a case, please listen to the whole episode and talk to someone like Liz, I would say, because otherwise it's a dangerous area to get into.
What's really scary for me, like as a lawyer, I feel like we think if we follow the rules that are in the statute, I should get to go, right? I should get my day. And it's really a difficult thing for people to grasp that you could file on time, you could observe every deadline in the statute, and you will still be kicked. That is troubling for a lot of people. I'll just say like one really last thing. You guys are probably sick of me, but There's one thing that's happened all the time that I probably should have mentioned before, because maybe somebody might listen and they'll stop doing it because it's so stressful for everyone else. When you do your ballot challenges, the statute says that if you want to challenge somebody's place on the ballot, you have to do it before the ballots go out in the primary. So people think they're going to get to litigate it before that. And that is almost never true. You have to file it and then suck it up until after the election. Between the primary and the general is when you litigate it every single year. Lawyers will read that statute and they'll say, yes, that's my deadline. And then they'll file it. And they might look up a couple of cases in the district, and not every single case is going to mention the Ferguson rule because it wasn't relevant, right? So they're going to go, yes, I have a case right here that says if these people on their petition don't live in the district, you can strike them. And now they don't have enough. I want you to kick them out. So they will get a TRO ex parte, like in Dallas, where you don't have to notify anybody except 2 hours before. They'll get a TRO. Then they'll set an injunction hearing, right? And they think because their opponent hasn't said anything that they understand that they're losing, right? Then they'll hold a whole injunction hearing that'll take 2 days, and they've spent $30,000 on this. They've got witnesses. They hired an investigator. They had some poor guy go knock on the door of all these voters, and they're like, I can prove to you these people don't live, whatever it is. When they're done, we'll stand up and say, this is very fascinating. Ballots go out in 2 days, so sorry, Charlie. And then the judge says, yeah, you're out of here. And the guy is just completely distraught. It undermines the relationship between lawyers and clients, and it undermines people's faith in the system because they're like, what are you talking about? We did all this work. I spent a bunch of money. I paid an investigator. This took forever. We sat here for 2 days. I took off work. I paid a sheriff to subpoena 15 people. What do you mean? And the lawyers are like, but I filed when the deadline said I filed before the ballots went out. And that is not the only thing that matters. You're restrained by the schedule. And it doesn't seem like a big deal, but it happens so often. And it's usually an attorney who is like, I'm a civil litigator. I do injunctions all the time. I read the statute. It's not fine. While you may walk away and be like, that was expensive. It was an expensive lesson for me. That was a super expensive lesson for your client. A really expensive one, but it was also a massive pain in the butt for everybody administering the election. Because when that happens, the election administrator sometimes has to come down there, and the DA who represents them has to come down there. And I've seen people subpoena the Secretary of State. I've seen them subpoena the AG. They've got the party chair, and the election's happening. Like, people are working around the clock to get mail-in ballots out, to go through ones that have come back in, to make sure they have everything they need for those federal employees overseas, like State Department employees and the military to vote. And instead, they're spending 7 hours in this courtroom, and everybody knows that it doesn't matter. And a lot of judges want you to have your record because they definitely don't want to come back and do the same thing again in 3 months, right? So they'll let you do it, and we all sit there. When you're done, everybody's furious. And it was a bunch of money, and it was a bunch of court time. It's also unfair to the court because those have to be heard. If you said it, they have to hear it. The only thing that goes in front of an election matter in the Civil Practices and Remedies Code is criminal, constitutional issues, death penalty, and SAPSR orders. So you can bully your way to the front of every single line, and people get, especially if you live there, you do not want to be that person. The clerk will be mad at you. The judge will be mad at you. The DA will be mad at you. Everyone will be mad at you for months. You don't want to walk around in the courthouse knowing that they're like, they can see me. I can feel it. It's awful. I hope that I can spare somebody out there who thinks this is a good plan. Please don't do it. Please don't do it.
That is, I think, great advice. But we don't want to let you go today without following our usual pattern of asking for a tip or a war story from our guest. And so, Liz, we've got a lot of takeaways from what you talked about today, but do you have a parting tip or a war story to share with our viewers and listeners?
You know what? Did you know I'm the only lawyer who's ever litigated an election contest, won the contest, and their client won the subsequent new election? And her name is Judge Tracy Gray. She's a district court judge in Kaufman County. And that election contest was probably, I've done a lot of stuff. I used to work overseas. I used to do human rights law. I worked on like some genocide tribunals and stuff, but this was still the coolest thing I've ever seen happen in front of my face. We found this woman who was filling out mail-in ballots for other people. And I had her on the stand. This woman is under oath. And she had a lawyer. I asked the judge twice I had to stop and ask him for an admonishment. And he was like, starting to admonish her before she answered my question. And she's like, oh, this lady stands up and is like, I'm her attorney. And I'm thinking, are you asleep? And the judge is like, well, I'm not going to admonish her anymore if she has a lawyer. So then she proceeds to tell us that, yes, She filled out a bunch of ballots for these people because they like her and they totally trust her to fill them out. You know, she keeps the extras at the house. And I'm like, what do you mean the extras? How many extras? Texas is a different state. In Texas, you can't even, you have to apply for a mail-in ballot. You have to fill in the thing that says, I request an application. They don't just give them out. The law says they can only send you an application if you request it. So first you have to request the application. Then they send it to you, fill it out. You send it back, then they approve it. This woman requested applications for a whole host of elderly and infirm individuals and then got their ballots and then filled them out and voted them all the same way and had no problem telling the judge she did so. She was proud of herself, actually. She was telling the judge that she had the extras still. And I said, wait a minute, what extras? And she goes, oh, you know, I just keep them around. They're really good quality paper. And I'm like, what do you mean? And she's like, they work really great for lists and stuff. And she reaches into her purse and pulls out somebody else's ballot by mail that she had in her purse. And she had written down her grocery list on it. And it was like her grocery list and then a note that was like, please call Pastor so-and-so about choir practice on Tuesday. And I was like, I don't know what I thought was going to happen, but it wasn't that. I'm in a John Grisham novel. This is crazy. When you're litigating, sometimes you get to a point where you're like, I have totally won. I have super won. I am the winningest winner that's ever won. But this is not even that. This was like, I don't understand what's happening. Like, I cannot compute that a person would know that that's what we thought she did. It would show up and cop to like 10 felonies, right? With a lawyer sitting there who's, I guess, asleep, and then yank the evidence out of her purse. And I was like, hey, do you mind if I look at that? I want to see what kind of paper that is. And she hands it to me. And the moment I had it in my hands, the judge was like, give it to me. Give it to me right now. We gave it to her. And he was like, this can't be happening. He's like, how many of these do you have? She's like, I don't know. He's like, besides the ones you filled out and voted already in this race, how many applications do you have? Because when you apply for a mail-in ballot, you can get it for a whole period, like a whole election cycle, right? It's called an application for an annual ballot by mail. So when you fill it out, you tell them, I'm going to vote in this primary and the general and the municipal and so you're applying to get like 8 ballots over the course of the next year and a half or whatever. So she then tells him that she has dozens of these just hanging out at her house. And I thought, it's amazing, but not amazing. You know what I mean? It was terrible.
Not amazing in a good way.
No, not amazing in a good way. Definitely in a, like, there's an Eddie Izzard skit from a long time ago or a routine where he talks about how some people are criminals and you think that is terrible. And then when you get to a certain point where they've committed so much, the magnitude of their crime is so extensive that you think, you know, that's almost impressive. You have to get up super early in the morning to get that kind of stuff accomplished. And I just remember thinking, that is, imagine if she had a real job. You know what I mean? Like, that's ambitious. Those people are real. It occurs. Like I said, it's not very common, but that was maybe the craziest thing I've ever had happen. To this day, you know, she got investigated by the agent. There's all the after effects of copping to several felonies on the stand are never positive. But I remember the whole time I was sitting there thinking, I feel like maybe I should find out. Should I tell the bar? This woman says she's a lawyer. She says she's hurt. She's objected to nothing. The judge gave her multiple opportunities to plead the fifth. And she was like, no, I'd love to tell you about how I figured out how to get all these and where I keep them and demonstrate my culpability by showing current possession of someone else's ballot. Absolutely zero problems. Whenever I think, man, I'm stupid, you know, when everybody has imposter syndrome, I remind myself, I have never let my client plead to cop to several felonies and then produce the illicit evidence of a crime on the stand. So I feel like I'm fine.
In open court.
Yeah, so I feel like I'm fine. That's how I remind myself, I'm not that person.
So interesting.
If that's your measuring stick, then yeah, I think you're fine. That was truly a war story, not one that we get something like every time. So thank you for sharing that. And thanks for being with us. It's highly educational.
You're welcome. We have the transcript of that exchange framed in the office because it's crazy.
Totally can. Well, we appreciate your time, Liz. It's very informative. And so thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. It was really nice to meet you guys.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your colleagues and rate and review the show on your favorite podcast platform. To connect with us, suggest a topic, or inquire about being a guest, visit texapplawpod.com or find us on LinkedIn and X at @texapplawpod. Produced and powered by Law Pods. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.